Thank you so much, Jana, and good morning to all of you. It's great to be back in Berlin. I've been in Berlin many, many times before, but this is the first time I'm on a boat on this river, and not only on a boat on the river, but on an electric boat. It's great to see what you achieve in Germany and in Berlin. Then, of course, it is an honor to once again participate in NATO Talk. And I would like to thank all my hosts and the German Atlantic Association and the Federal Academy for Security Policy for inviting me here today. And then let me also say that it is always great to be in Berlin and in Germany, because Germany is a very highly valued ally, contributing to our transatlantic security in many different ways. From Baltic air policing to maritime deployment in the Aegean Sea, and from leading the multinational NATO battle group in Lithuania to our new logistics command in Ulm. And Germany has also been a long-standing supporter of our peacekeeping mission in Kosovo. And as you all know, Germany was the second largest troop contributor to our mission in Afghanistan. So all of these contributions demonstrate the strong commitment of Germany to NATO, to our transatlantic bond, and it's highly valued by NATO and by all of us. In an increasingly dangerous and competitive world, this commitment is as important as ever. Today, we face many different challenges. Russia carries out aggressive actions. It interferes in other countries' affairs. It has invested significantly in military capabilities, including new advanced nuclear weapons. And Russia continues its massive military buildup, as we see now around the borders of Ukraine. And it has shown a willingness to use military force against its neighbors. Meanwhile, China is using its might to coerce other countries and control its own people. It is investing heavily in new technologies like hypersonic glide vehicles, expanding its global economic and military footprint in Africa, in the Arctic, and in cyberspace. And China is suppressing democracy and human rights at home. We don't regard China as an adversary, but we need to take into account the consequences for our security, the rise of China. In addition, we face more frequent and sophisticated cyber attacks, hybrid tactics, as we see today from Belarus on the border with Poland. We also face persistent terrorist threats, the proliferation of nuclear weapons, and the security implications of climate change. These challenges are all very different, but they have one thing in common, and that is that the best way to tackle them is to stay united, Europe and North America, together in NATO. That is why reinforcing the transatlantic unity and strengthening NATO is so important right now. There is strong bipartisan support for our alliance, for NATO, in the United States. The United States wants more cooperation with Europe. They have demonstrated this not just in words, but also in deeds. In recent years, the United States has increased its military presence in Europe, with more troops, more exercises, and more pre-positioned equipment. And for me, that is actually a very strong demonstration of commitment to transatlantic security, that they actually increase their presence in Europe. The US commitment to NATO was reiterated at our Brussels summit in June this year, when President Biden, together with Chancellor Merkel and all the other NATO leaders, adopted NATO 2030, an ambitious and forward-looking agenda for our security. We took bold decisions to strengthen our alliance even more, as the indispensable forum to consult, decide, and when necessary, act on all issues that affect our security. We decided to sharpen our technological edge, so we are investing in the latest technologies, from artificial intelligence to biotech and quantum computers. We are developing a defense innovation accelerator for the North Atlantic, what we call DIANA, to facilitate transatlantic cooperation and exchanges on critical technologies. And recently launched a new NATO Innovation Fund with full involvement from Germany to invest in startups that will build and help us meet security needs and strengthen the technological bond between Europe and North America. At the summit in Brussels, we also decided to address the impact of climate change on our security. So allies are investing in sustainable solutions, and we welcome the fact that we have an electric boat demonstrating what sustainable solutions might be. We invest in biofuels for jet aircraft and solar panels to power equipment. And for the first time, NATO is developing a way to map military emissions across the alliance. That's the first step to be able to cut those emissions. On technology, climate, and many other areas, we are committed to working even more closely with our partners, not least with the European Union. NATO and the EU are different organizations with different members, different roles, and different tools. But more than 90% of EU citizens live in a NATO country. So we face the same security threats, we share the same values, and we have lifted the cooperation between NATO and the European Union, to unprecedented levels. My ambition is to strengthen our partnership still further. So I'm now working with President von der Leyen and President Michel on a new joint declaration between the two EU presidents and myself to chart the way forward for further strengthening NATO-EU cooperation. As I have said many times, I welcome European efforts on defense. NATO has been calling on European allies for many years to invest more and provide more capabilities. It is good news that allies, including Germany, are stepping up. At the same time, we must avoid creating parallel structures in the EU that would compete for the same limited pool of resources and forces that we rely on for our NATO alliance. What we need is new capabilities, not new structures. These are pivotal times for Europe, for international security. That is why I count on Germany to continue to invest in defense. NATO's 2% guideline reflects clearly defined capability targets and requirements that we have all agreed to meet. I also count on Germany to strengthen European security within a transatlantic framework. You are at the heart of Europe with its largest economy, and you are a champion of multilateralism. So Germany has a special responsibility to keep NATO strong. This means providing more and new capabilities, soldiers that are well-trained and well-equipped, planes that can fly, and ships that can sail. And I count on Germany to remain committed to NATO's nuclear sharing. It is our ultimate security guarantee. Our aim is a world free of nuclear weapons. But as long as others have them, NATO must have them too. The nuclear weapons we share in NATO provide European allies with an effective nuclear umbrella. This, of course, also includes our Eastern allies. And they are an important signal of allied unity against any nuclear-armed adversary. So NATO's nuclear sharing arrangements are of particular importance for Europe. In today's uncertain world, we are safer when Europe and North America stand together in strategic solidarity with a strong Germany at the heart of our alliance. Thank you, and then I'm ready to take your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much on behalf of everybody here and also our audience. Unfortunately, we need to say goodbye to Mr. Schmidt, who has now to leave for more important tasks.
So this is not important.
No. Equally important. Yeah. I'm not a diplomat. No. Equally important tasks. But I'm very happy that you agreed to take some questions by the audience, by me, by our audience in front of the screens, and also by leading journalists of Germany. And maybe we start with what you started your talk with, the question of Russia, and also you talked about the Belarusian border with Poland, with Lithuania, with Latvia. And looking at this, it seems that the situation is more and more kind of on the brink of an outright escalation. The Americans are very worried. Mr. Blinken has stated that he fears that 2014 will repeat itself, looking at Ukraine. And the Poles have just suggested to activate NATO's Article 4 for political consultations. So how do you watch this situation when you look at Russia, not only in Ukraine, but Russia's involvement more broadly, and also the question of NATO's role in all this and NATO's role when it comes to the border question with Belarus and Poland? Is there one for NATO?
We are deeply concerned about what we see, both close to the borders of Ukraine with a Russian military buildup and the difficult situation on the border between Poland and Belarus, but also actually we have seen similar situations, not perhaps the same scale, but similar situations on the border between two other NATO allied countries, Lithuania and Latvia and Belarus. And when it comes to that situation on the border with Belarus, of course, what we see is that the Lukashenko regime is using vulnerable people as a tool to put pressure on other countries. And that is inhumane, it's cynical, and it's something which is really a proof or demonstration of what we mean by hybrid tactics. This is serious. We stand in full solidarity with Poland and the other allies that are directly affected. This has been addressed several times at NATO. We agreed a strong statement a few days ago condemning this behavior of the Lukashenko regime. We have also welcomed the efforts by not least Germany and Chancellor Merkel. I think it's important that we also send a clear message that NATO allies and Poland and the others will not be coerced into changing their behavior. This is a tactic that should not succeed. The situation is serious, but we have seen a few steps in the right direction. We have seen that, for instance, close NATO partners as Iraq are now helping and cooperating, partly to help to stop the flights that are bringing people out of Iraq and to the border of Belarus and Poland. And we've also seen some of those people who went to Belarus actually returning. So it remains a serious and difficult situation, but I think we need to work together to try to find a political solution, also working with partners. When it comes to and then, of course, we have consulted, and also NATO has actually deployed teams of experts or some experts to Lithuania. We did that earlier this fall to help them deal with a difficult situation. Then when it comes to Ukraine, what we see is once again a significant Russian military buildup. We see an unusual concentration of forces. We see them close to Ukraine's borders, but we also see them in Crimea, occupied Ukrainian territory. Therefore, we call on Russia to be transparent on their on what they do. We call on Russia to de-escalate, to prevent escalation, and to reduce tensions. This is actually part of a pattern we have seen over several years, especially since 2014. What we have seen is a significant Russian military buildup. And we've also seen that Russia has not only the capabilities, but also the will to use force against neighbors, against Ukraine, against Crimea as part of Ukraine, against Georgia. And they still have military forces in Moldova against the will of the government. So this is part of a pattern. And NATO has responded partly by providing support to Ukraine, political support, military support, training, capacity building, and allies are also stepping up. Second, we are, of course, monitoring closely what is going on there. And not least, we have implemented the biggest reinforcement of our collective defense since the end of the Cold War as a direct response to Russia's aggressive actions against Ukraine. With battle groups in the eastern part of the alliance, with high readiness of our forces, triple the size of the NATO response force to 45,000 troops, and also by increased defense spending, air policing, and many other measures. This is a clear message to Russia and any other potential adversary that we are there to defend and protect all NATO allies.
Thank you very much. Another question that came to my mind while listening to you is the NATO's strategic concept, which is basically the project for the upcoming month. And I was wondering if you were kind of the only person responsible for the content, if it was only up to you, what would be in there? What do you want to see? You were kind of the pen holder, and it
but
was
you know,
all
my,
your responsibility.
My main responsibility is to make sure that we have a good strategic concept, a forward-looking, ambitious strategic concept, when we agree it finally at the NATO summit in Madrid next year. And if I start to outline the details now, I will reduce the likelihood of having the concept I would like to have.
Okay.
So therefore, you just have to accept that my role is not to be a kind of private individual saying exactly what I want now, but to facilitate the process of 30 allies working together to achieve consensus agreement on an ambitious and forward-looking strategic concept. But I can just share with you some reflections. And the first is that the current strategic concept that was agreed in Lisbon in 2010, that strategic concept has served NATO well. And it is an important document. It is the most important document next to our founding treaty, the Washington Treaty. But what we have seen is that over those 10 years or so, the world has changed. Because if you look into the current strategic concept, we address Russia as a strategic partner. We don't mention China with a single word, and for instance, climate change, the security consequences of climate change is hardly mentioned. So it is obvious that since the world has changed, we also need to update and agree a new strategic concept, and that's exactly what we are doing. And therefore, I expect the strategic concept to be very clear on our core values: democracy, rule of law. I expect the strategic concept, of course, to send a very clear message of the need for North America and Europe to stand together. That is the success of NATO. We are 30 different allies, and of course there are differences, and there have always been differences. But the success of NATO is that despite these differences, we have been able to unite around our core task to protect and defend each other. That was important during the Cold War, but in many ways it's even more important now, because we face an even more unpredictable and in many ways more uncertain world than we did 20, 30 years ago. So to recommit to the transatlantic bond, Europe and North America stand together. I also expect hope will be part of the strategic concept. And then also take into account the security consequences of the rise of China, knowing that that has consequences for our security. Many other issues, but I think I stop there.
Thank you very much.
To ask you, do you have water on this
boat? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Can we get some water for Mr. Stoltenberg, please? I think it's coming.
Yeah.
So you were not willing to share kind of your darling...
But I shared some darlings now.
Yeah. But maybe you could also give us a hint what you think would be the most controversial topics when we discuss the concept now. So what do you think will be the kind of stumbling blocks?
No, but again, if I start to list that, I will only make my task more difficult. Because really, there are many people, and experts and journalists and media, they will use almost all their time to identify the difficulties. So if I add to that, I will actually just make the whole process more difficult. My task is to find the positive approach, to find the solutions, to find how to deal with the differences. And everyone that can see that there are differences between 30 allies. So that's not, you don't require a high degree of intellectual capacity to in a way identify differences. So the impressive thing is not to identify differences or disagreements. The impressive and important task is to actually, based on those differences or taking that into account, to find the common ground. That's my task.
Yeah, and based on this, I think NATO has a tremendous track record, as is also mapped out in the publication that the Deutsche Atlantische Gesellschaft will publish today. So you are absolutely right, and we have a lot of journalists on board who can ask critical questions and identify stumbling blocks. I open it up now to you and also to comments that come in online. And the first on my list is Reinhard Bütikofer, who is a Green politician and represents part of the traffic light coalition in the making on board. Could you hand over?
I think I can shout.
No, there is a mic coming.
This is live streamed, so you cannot shout. Even you.
thank you very much. I'm still getting acquainted to a new role, I guess. Secretary General, thank you for your remarks. My question is this. The tensions within and around Bosnia and Herzegovina are escalating. What role do you foresee for NATO in that context?
First of all, we are following the developments in the Western Balkans in general, and Bosnia and Herzegovina in particular, with concern, because we have seen some increased tensions, some challenges. We saw it in Kosovo and Serbia recently, and now we have seen also some developments in the wrong direction, and some inflammatory rhetoric in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And NATO feels that NATO has a responsibility, partly because Bosnia and Herzegovina, the Western Balkans, is in the middle of Europe. We have a history there. We helped to end the two ethnic wars in Bosnia and Herzegovina and later on Kosovo, Serbia. What we do is, of course, that we are working closely with Bosnia and Herzegovina. We are making progress on how we help them with capacity building, how we work with their armed forces. And we have also made some progress on how we actually have stepped up our partnership with Bosnia and Herzegovina. I think this is particularly important as we see increased tensions now, because one of the few, or perhaps the only really multi-ethnic institution in Bosnia and Herzegovina is the armed forces, very much trained and supported by NATO. So I think it also proves the value of the NATO presence together with the EU in trying to build some institutions, and the armed forces is actually perhaps the only one that is truly multi-ethnic. So we will continue to provide support capacity building. We will continue to support the efforts of Christian Schmidt and many others to try to find political solutions. And and then also continue to provide support to Bosnia and Herzegovina on their Euro-Atlantic aspirations. And then, of course, it is also important to also call on all other countries to not add fuel to the fire or to stimulate or support this idea of breaking with the Dayton Agreement and everything that has actually created some peace and stability in the region.
I have two questions online, one by Jill Long and one anonymous, addressing the same issue. Both are asking about cyber attacks and malign influence crossing military and economic domains. So cyber conflict as a very important theater now and even more so in the future. How does NATO adapt?
Well, I think cyber is it's an example of how NATO has been able to change as the world changes. Of course, not so many years ago, cyber was not an important part of our military posture and what we did as an alliance. Then over the last years, we have really made cyber an important task for NATO, because we see that cyber is becoming a domain where we see frequent and more sophisticated attacks and aggressive actions. And I think it also demonstrates that that the line between peace and war is more blurred now than before, because we see almost constant attacks in cyberspace. What we have done in NATO are different things. We have, first of all, we have declared, agreed, that a cyber attack can trigger Article 5, meaning that we regard cyber attacks as potentially as damaging as a kinetic attack. So an attack in cyberspace can trigger our collective defense clause, Article 5. Then we are free to respond in cyberspace or in any other domain. That's up to us to decide. Second, we have established cyber as a military domain. So we have air, land, sea, and cyber, and actually also space. And thirdly, we have developed and strengthened our cyber capabilities, partly to protect NATO networks, but also to help and support allies in protecting their networks, sharing best practices. And we have regularly big cyber exercises to improve our capabilities and the way we are able to operate together. So cyber is actually an area where NATO do a lot, and where we really need 30 allies to work together.
Thank you very much. And just a hint to everybody on board who wants to ask a question, just I would appreciate a raised hand so that I can basically look how many questions there are. And there was one over there. And I would like to ask you to introduce yourself to the Secretary General.
Yes, thank you. Hans-Peter Bartels, former Parliamentary Commissioner for the Armed Forces. A simple question. Germany is the biggest member of NATO in Europe, is the most economic powerful nation in Europe, and in military means and in terms of military power, what is the contribution NATO needs most of Germany? Is it Air Force? Is it Navy? Is it the Army? Is it special means that Germany can bring in a stronger NATO? Where is the shortfall Germany can help?
We need all of that. Also, meaning we need many different capabilities from Germany, but in general, I can say that what we need is more high-end capabilities. We need more heavy, high-end capabilities, because I think you have to realize that for many years, European allies reduced defense spending after the Cold War, and of course that had an impact, also long-term impact on our defense capabilities. Then for some years, we were very focused on expeditionary operations like Afghanistan. That was important, but that required a special type of more light and not high-end heavy weapons systems, not capabilities responding to peer adversaries or state-to-state competition. Now, especially since 2014, things have changed. And actually what has happened in NATO is a kind of fundamental shift from focusing on out-of-area missions in Afghanistan and that type of challenges to coming home and do collective defense in Europe. And that requires, as I said, heavier, high-end capabilities in all those domains, in air, sea, land, but also cyber. And of course, Germany being the biggest economy in Europe and Germany having the largest defense budget in continental Europe, of course, you have to provide not only one type of capabilities, but a wide range of capabilities. High end, but the other thing is that we need higher readiness. So well-trained, well-equipped, high readiness forces is also something we expect from Germany. There is a detailed list because we agree something called capability targets in NATO. So this is not only kind of abstract thing. It's a concrete list where we allocate capability targets for all allies and then of course also for Germany. The only way to meet those targets, capability targets, is to invest more. So therefore, I'm calling on Germany and other allies to do what we agreed to increase defense investments.
Thank you very much. Just to warn you, there are a hell lot of questions incoming. Oh, yeah. And I also want to give the floor to our colleagues from the press. And in order to identify you, could you maybe raise kind of two hands at once so that yeah, over there. Fabulous. So that I know that you are from the press. And could you just, COVID numbers in Germany are raising and maybe you could all wear your mask even while seated. We are at a small ship. There is not a lot of air circulation. It would just be, I think, I know that it's bothers, but would be kind if you could wear a mask. So.
Klaus Rebbe from German National Radio, Deutschlandfunk. I wonder, with respect to Belarus, Article 4 is mentioned more and more frequently, and I think it was part of a question to you up front. I wonder whether you could address that aspect in specific. I mean, is it a useful tool right now, given the situation on the ground which you described, or is there not a danger of militarizing a conflict which is dangerous as it is?
We are deeply concerned about the situation on the border between Poland and Belarus. I have spoken with the Polish president. We have been in Poland has briefed and updated NATO allies. We have discussed this several times at NATO, and a few days ago we also agreed a strong statement. So there are ongoing consultations at NATO, and we stand in solidarity. We are ready to also provide support. But I think the most important thing regarding that situation is to actually solve the difficult situation on the border. And I welcome the fact that also NATO and other countries have engaged with our partners, including Iraq, to help to partly stop the flow of people coming to the border and also now to help to take people back. So we are constantly and in regular consultation with a close NATO ally, Poland, and we will continue to do that as long as necessary.
Thank you. And just an announcement, I worried you too much. Basically, the air circulation here is as if we were in an airplane, so it's excellent. But still, I think, or I know that some amongst you feel more comfortable if everybody wears a mask. So still wearing the mask, but feel safe because this ship is super equipped. And before I come back again to basically people on board, because we try to involve as many students as possible in this endeavor. And the Hochschule für Sicherheitspolitik Kiel, so a group of students at the University of Kiel, ask a question which links perfectly to the question you just answered, because they are asking what you think is then the difference between Belarus using refugees as a tool of negotiations and Turkey doing the same.
Turkey is the NATO ally that has received the highest number of refugees, millions. And they are hosting close to 4 million refugees. And we have, of course, worked with Turkey to also address that situation. And I welcome the fact that actually there is an agreement between Turkey and the European Union, and that NATO is helping to implement that agreement, because we have the NATO presence in the Aegean Sea. It has been a German flagship ever since it started. I think it was back in 2015. So I think that we see the advantage of having NATO as a platform that brings Turkey together with other NATO allies and actually also the European Union to enable our presence in the Aegean Sea to help to implement the agreement between Turkey and the European Union addressing the flow of migrants across the Aegean.
Thank you very much. And we go back to a guest on board. And you cannot get the mic for corona reasons.
Okay. It's okay. Yeah, good morning, Mr. Stoltenberg. My name is Christian Grimm. I'm a reporter for the Augsburger Allgemeine. It's a paper from the south of Germany. And I wanted to ask you if there are demands from the Eastern European NATO partners to even reinforce the existing battle groups, given the current situation.
And if there are demands, how they would be answered?
So we are constantly assessing the need for presence of NATO troops in the whole of Alliance, but especially in the East. We have really increased. Before 2014, we didn't have any combat-ready troops in the eastern part of the Alliance at all. Now we have four battle groups. And the importance with these battle groups is that they are multinational. So it's a NATO presence. One is led by Canada, another by the United Kingdom, United States, and then Germany in Lithuania. And actually, Heine Brauser is here. He was the driving force to get that those forces in place as part of what we decided at our summit in Warsaw. Then we are constantly assessing the need to adjust our posture. But I would like to say that this is not only about the presence of troops in the Baltic region. It's also about air policing and maritime presence. We have, for instance, now seen some more naval presence in the Black Sea region. And it is also about readiness. It's about our ability to reinforce quickly if needed. So just over the last few years, we have tripled the size of the NATO response force, and we have implemented something we call the readiness initiative, which is significantly increasing the availability of ready forces that can be deployed quickly if needed. So we should, of course, not only focus on troops in that region, but our ability to reinforce when needed. Cyber is part of this. And of course, you cannot count that as the same way as you count troops. But whatever we do, and we are doing a lot on cyber, also matters for these countries. And then lastly, I would say that the fact that allies are investing more provides us with more capabilities that are also relevant for the eastern part of the lines.
Thank you very much. Another press question? And then I have a very good question from our online audience, but first, over here.
Paul Krüger with Süddeutsche Zeitung, Secretary General. One of the documents that is governing the relationship between Russia and NATO is the Founding Act. Mm. Given the behavior by Russia, do you think that it's still a viable document to define that relationship? And if I may, another question regarding nuclear sharing, as you mentioned it in your keynote speech. If Germany would reduce its role, what would that mean, especially for the NATO Founding Act and the situation of the Allies eastward?
So first, on the nuclear sharing, let me once again reiterate that NATO's goal is a world without nuclear weapons. No one likes nuclear weapons. But the reality is that, of course, when others have them, we also will need to have nuclear weapons to make sure that we have significant nuclear deterrence. And the way to work towards a world without nuclear weapons, at least with fewer nuclear weapons, is to balanced, verifiable arms control. And therefore, NATO has been on the forefront of arms control for years. And since the end of the Cold War, we have reduced the number of nuclear weapons in Europe by 90%. And we have been working hard, for instance, for the INF treaty that was key for banning all intermediate range weapons. And also we welcomed the agreement between Russia and the United States on extending New START, limiting the long-range nuclear weapons. We, of course, very much regret that Russia violated the INF treaty, which led to the demise of the treaty. And they did that by deploying intermediate-range nuclear-capable missiles, violating the INF treaty. The nuclear sharing is important because it's an arrangement where NATO allies go together and provide the nuclear deterrence. It's a multilateral arrangement among NATO allies. It gives also a country like Germany a seat at the table. We have agreed doctrines, exercises, command and control. So it actually makes the whole NATO responsible, and also that the whole of NATO has a say when you make decisions on nuclear issues. I think this is extremely important for European allies, because then we are involved and we take responsibility and we have a say. We just a few weeks ago have a meeting of the NATO nuclear planning group where allies are sitting together and taking important decisions on nuclear issues. And therefore, of course, I expect that Germany will continue to be part of nuclear sharing, because it is so important for the whole of Europe, and it's a multilateral framework. The alternative to NATO nuclear sharing is different kinds of bilateral arrangements, and also the risk of having, you know, nuclear weapons also. Well, Germany can, of course, decide whether there will be nuclear weapons in your country, but the alternative is that we easily end up with nuclear weapons in other countries in Europe, also to the east of Germany. So I think that nuclear sharing is a balanced, well-organized, tested structure for nuclear deterrence, something we have as we at the same time continue to work strongly for disarmament, non-proliferation, and arms control. And Germany is playing a key role, putting on the table in NATO important initiatives. And I really believe in this dual track, dialogue, arms control, combined with a strong deterrence and defense posture, including the nuclear sharing arrangements.
The NATO-Russia Founding Act, I think.
Yeah, well, you can all see that the NATO-Russia Founding Act is not working. And the main reason for that is, of course, Russia's behavior. Illegally annexing Crimea, violating the territorial integrity of an independent state in Europe. And then we have been working for dialogue with Russia. We saw some progress over some years, but now Russia has decided to close down the two NATO offices in Moscow and close down or suspend their diplomatic mission at NATO in Brussels. And of course, that makes it hard to implement the intentions of the NATO-Russia Founding Act. But we will continue to work for dialogue, because we strongly believe in this dual-track approach. We need a strong, predictable, united NATO. But based on that, we also can talk to Russia, partly to strive for a better relationship. But even if you don't believe in a better relationship with Russia in the foreseeable future or in the short run, we need to manage a difficult relationship, to have a risk reduction, to have transparency, to engage in arms control. So I continue to believe in dialogue with Russia, but I regret that Russia has not proven very willing to engage in dialogue with us.
Thank you very much. I have to sneak in one question from our online audience, because it fits so perfectly well to what you said about nuclear sharing and the whole issue. So it's not immediately related. Somebody is asking, how is NATO dealing with the fact that Norway is seeking observer status at the upcoming nuclear weapons ban conference? Looking at the coalition negotiations and looking at the debate we have, this is also a question maybe for Germany in the future. So what is your take?
So my take is that we all are aiming for a world without nuclear weapons. But I believe that the best way to achieve that is to balance verifiable arms control. A world where we get rid of our weapons, but China, Russia, and countries like North Korea retain their nuclear capabilities is not the safer world. So the only way to move towards nuclear disarmament is to balance verifiable reductions. And that's exactly what NATO has been working for years. And of course, we have seen some serious setbacks with, for instance, the demise of the INF Treaty. But we also have to recognize that over decades, we actually made a lot of progress with the INF Treaty and then also the START treaties to actually reduce significantly the number of warheads. When we had the in the beginning of the 1990s, there were 12,000 warheads, along also strategic warheads on each side. Now, with the new START, it's 1,550, which is significantly lower than we had not so many years ago. So we have proven that balanced, verifiable arms control works. Unilateral disarmament, which will be the consequence of the ban treaty, is not a way to make the world safer, and it's not the way towards a world free of nuclear weapons. Then, what I think is important also regarding also any move by any NATO ally is that we need to consult. We need to be unified on these very important issues, and consultations on all issues related to nuclear weapons, nuclear posture is something which applies for all NATO allies.
Clear position here from the Secretary General. I have more questions. I just wanted to give you a heads up. We have 17 minutes. We haven't talked about China, the Biden administration. So there are several things. So I ask you basically for sharp and precise and crispy questions. And we will have one over here.
Frank Jordan's Associated Press. I'd just like to follow up on two points you've already made. One on the border, the eastern border. Has NATO stepped up surveillance in its member state Poland and partner Ukraine lately that you can confidently say you know exactly what's going on both sides? And on climate change, if climate change is a security challenge, should national expenditure to respond to this threat be counted in any way towards defense expenditure?
Very grateful that you addressed climate change. It came up very often here also on Slido.
Okay, briefly on climate change. Climate change matters for our security. Climate change is a crisis multiplier. It fuels conflicts related to competition over scarce resources as water, land, and it forces millions of people to flee. So of course it actually exacerbates security challenges and it impacts security, and therefore it matters for NATO. NATO's role, we have three important roles to play or tasks. One is to fully understand the link between climate change and security. And we should be the lead organization in understanding that link. Second, we need to reduce the impact of our militaries on climate, because there's no way to reach the goal of net zero emissions without also reducing emissions from military operations and missions. And as I mentioned, we have very interesting developments and investments in, for instance, the use of biofuels for jet aircraft or solar panels for equipment and many other technologies. I strongly believe that we cannot either have green or strong armed forces. We need green and strong. So the challenge is in a way to find a way to combine the need for modern technologies, green technologies, with, of course, having the strong and the high-end capabilities we need. I believe that's absolutely possible. I think the best technologies in the future will actually be the green technologies. Then the third task of NATO is to reduce the impact on climate change on our forces, because we are operating out there in nature. Our military forces will be exposed to more extreme weather, heat waves, storms, increasing sea levels, melting polar ice. And of course, this matters for the way we are going to operate as armed forces. We have in Iraq a NATO training mission. They were exposed to more than 50 degrees Celsius over several days. So of course, it matters for uniforms, for whatever they do. So we have started this work at NATO. Then having said all that, of course, if you invest in the military capability, that reduces emissions, then it counts against the 2%. Yeah. So if that was the question, the answer is yes.
then surveillance.
Yeah, surveillance. Yeah. Well, I cannot go into the details of what we do when it comes to intelligence, but I can say that we are now closely monitoring the developments along the borders. This matters for NATO, and we have the capacity, we have the capabilities to collect information, to monitor closely, to understand what is going on there. And therefore also made it clear to Russia that we see the significant military buildup. We see an unusual concentration of forces, and we know that they have used these type of forces before to actually intervene and invade other countries, Georgia and Ukraine.
Still think that we haven't had a question on China, on the Biden administration, and on the EU. And the next journalist who wants to ask a question on either of them wins the pot. So, Mr. Steingart.
Let's talk about China. It's a good idea, I think. Mr. Stoltenberg, if it comes to a takeover, maybe an unfriendly takeover of this little island from China, what would be your response?
And also, maybe we can extend this a bit because we have several questions also from the audience. Looking at the AUKUS hiccup, I don't know what to say. What is basically, how do you envision the future role of the EU in the Indo-Pacific? And could that be part of the increased cooperation between NATO and the EU? Could that be on the Indo-Pacific, on China?
Yes, of course. But let me just briefly say on China more in general, then address the specific questions. We don't regard China as an adversary. We need to work with China. And of course, the rise of China has also had enormous positive consequences for the global economy. Important markets for all of us. And it has helped to lift hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. So that is something which has been good for the world. And we need to engage with China on issues like climate change, but not least also on, for instance, arms control. At the same time, we need to realize that when China now soon will have the biggest economy in the world, they already have the second largest defense budget, they have the biggest navy, they're investing heavily in new, very capable, modern military systems, including long-range nuclear weapons, hypersonic glide vehicles, systems that can go around the whole globe and reach also every NATO ally. It matters for our security. There's no way to deny that. And NATO should remain an alliance of North America and Europe. But in this region, we face global threats in space, in cyberspace, and also the fact that China has systems that can reach all of us. So I think we need to realize that perhaps we could have some kind of regional approach to security 50 years ago, but that's not possible anymore. So our responsibility is to protect Europe and North America. But to do so, we also need to address all these global challenges. And China's coming closer to us in space, in cyberspace. We see them in Africa. We see them in the Arctic. We see them trying to control critical infrastructure. We had a very important debate about 5G recently. So again, NATO has to address this together. And the only way to address that is to do it together. That applies for Europe, but it also applies for the United States. And the good thing is that the United States, they really realize that it is a great advantage for the United States to have 29 friends and allies. Because compared to China, the United States is not so big anymore. They used to be the biggest, but they should not have the biggest economy. And the aim of China is to have the most advanced and strongest military capabilities within a few decades. And they invest. What we do now on nuclear is really big. They are building many new silos for missiles, and they're investing in extremely advanced technologies. So therefore, on Taiwan, I will only say that the most important task now is to prevent any conflict. And if I start to speculate about what we will do or not do, I think I will fuel or add to the tensions. So we need to prevent any incidents, accidents, conflict there, and find political solutions. Was there anything more? Yeah, AUKUS. AUKUS.
Yeah, well, or the EU more broadly, yeah, and its constructive role.
So first on AUKUS. AUKUS was not directed against NATO. I understand that France was disappointed. That's absolutely understandable. But of course, we have to continue to, as NATO, to work with our close partners in the Asia-Pacific region, New Zealand, Australia, Japan, and South Korea. And of course, we can also work together with the European Union. More in general, I welcome EU efforts on defense. And any meaningful effort by European allies on defense requires more spending. And there is one thing NATO has been calling for years, is more European defense spending. So we not only welcome, we actually work hard to achieve more European efforts on defense. Because there's no way you can get more European efforts on defense without investing more. And we have lists of capabilities we actually expect European allies to deliver. And therefore, we ask them to invest more. The good news is that European allies are doing exactly that. For 7 consecutive years, defense spending has increased across Europe and Canada. They have added 260 billion extra for defense, and Germany is part of that increase. Back when we made the decision in 2014, 3 allies met the 2% guideline, now 10 allies, and all other allies have increased. So increased European efforts on defense, meaning defense spending, is not only welcomed, but actually encouraged by NATO and pushed by NATO. We do this also to have more capabilities. Planes, drones, battle tanks, cyber, all that, and not least higher readiness. So when European efforts or EU efforts on defense means more spending and more capabilities, is strongly encouraged by NATO. What we need to avoid is duplication. And therefore, we say that we welcome and encourage more European capabilities, but not new structures, only competing for the same pool of forces. And therefore, we also strongly believe that NATO remains the backbone for European security. We have readiness forces if needed, also for, of course, European allies. The fact is that EU allies, put it the other way, non-EU allies account for 80% of NATO's defense spending. And this is not only about resources, but also about geography. Norway and Iceland in the north, the critical North Atlantic link. Turkey in the south, important to fight terrorism. Of course, in the West, the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom, if we look at the map, you realize that this geography matters for European security. But most importantly, this is not only about resources. 80% of defense spending comes from non-EU allies. Geography, you see the map. But it's most importantly about politics. Any attempt to weaken the transatlantic bond will not only weaken NATO, it will divide Europe. So we just have to stand together. And in a more dangerous, unpredictable world, the need to stand together, Europe and North America, is as strong as ever. So this is not the time to weaken that.
Thank you very much. Now you answered China and the United States, kind of 2 birds and 1 stone. That is very efficient, and we need to be efficient, because in motorsports, one would say we are nearing the finishing line. I don't know if that applies to ships, but we have not more than 8 minutes left. So there are 2 questions, one over there, and a third one over there. So maybe we start now grouping questions, and then you can get a better idea what people are also, in addition, interested in. Werner Sonne.
Daniel Sonne from the board of the German Atlantic Association. One very important tool of cooperation between East and West used to be the Open Sky Treaty, which unfortunately has also been cancelled. Now, I'm wondering, is there any readiness on the part of NATO to reinvent or to go back to this treaty? Are you ready to talk with Russia to go back to this very important tool?
So about the future, maybe also about the future of arms control more broadly, looking that the United States is now talking to Russia and that we already have first results. Maybe you can comment on this as well. Then the lady at the table over there, she has a question.
Okay. Good morning. My name is Joanna Musaki, and I'm a student of war and conflict studies and vice chair in the university group about security policy in Potsdam. You have mentioned Europe and how the European allies have been stepping up and how they spent more over the past 7 years. My question is more about the strategic role of the European allies. In 2011, we had for the first time with Libya, European allies taking the lead and the US taking a role from behind, as they called it. So I wanted to ask you if you see that this stepping up in the strategic, the strategic stepping up of the European allies stopped in 2011, or if they keep making progress in that aspect of
Thank you very much. And maybe you can could comment on the strategic compass, just maybe if you have a footnote on this, which was just presented in its first version a couple of days ago, in capturing the European strategic ambitions. And there is one last question you can win. Over here.
Yes, Secretary General.
Could you introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Hajo Gisman. I'm a member of board of the German Atlantic Association. My question relates to NATO Resolute Support mission in Afghanistan. Since that was not very successful at the end, my question is, what are the consequences for future engagement in doing trainings outside of Europe by NATO?
So three areas and 5 minutes.
Okay, fine. Then I think we should start with the last one, Afghanistan. I think we have to remember that we went into Afghanistan to fight international terrorism, to degrade Al-Qaeda that was responsible for a terrorist attack against NATO allied, the United States. Over 20 years, we have prevented Afghanistan from being a safe haven for international terrorists, prevented any attack organized on any NATO ally, planned, organized from Afghanistan, and we have degraded Al-Qaeda. So our mission was not in vain. Having said that, of course, I realized that what happened in Afghanistan during the summer and in August with the return of Taliban is a tragedy for Afghan people, and it's heartbreaking for all those who sacrificed the families that lost family members in Afghanistan, including German families. But we need to have this kind of balanced approach. That was a tragedy. At the same time, the mission was not in vain because the main task, the main purpose to fight terrorism, we actually achieved a lot. Now the aim is, of course, to preserve the gains in the fight against terrorism and to hold the Taliban accountable for what they promised and also to actually be honest on our lessons learned, because I have launched a lessons learned process in NATO. It's too early for me to preempt all those conclusions, but I can just share with you a few reflections. One is that, of course, what we saw in Afghanistan was that we started with a well-defined and kind of a narrow aim to fight terrorism. And then gradually that evolved into a big ambition of nation building to create a more stable, democratic Afghanistan, which is an aim I supported. But it's a much more ambitious aim than fighting terrorism. And of course, NATO was part of that, but that was a responsibility for the whole international community. I was Prime Minister of Norway. I was pushing that agenda hard. So this is responsibility not only for NATO, but for individual allies. Most allies have spent more development aid money to try to build a democratic, peaceful Afghanistan in Afghanistan than military spending. The UN, EU, all of us had this ambition of a peaceful, democratic Afghanistan, that we didn't achieve. So we need to think carefully about increasing the level of ambition when we go into these kind of missions and operations. But that's not only a NATO lesson. It's a lesson for the whole international community. The second thing is that we should not draw the wrong conclusions. Of course, NATO and NATO allies have to be ready to deploy forces again to fight the international terrorism if needed, as we have done in degrading ISIS in Iraq and Syria. There is no way we can achieve that without using military force. And now we continue to train the Afghan security forces to help them prevent ISIS from returning. Last thing on Afghanistan is that it was a difficult decision, but we made it together. We had three ministerial meetings, many committee meetings in NATO, consulting on the decision. We knew when we made the decision that this was a difficult decision. If we decided to stay, the risk was an open-ended military mission with more fighting, more violence, more casualties, and most likely the need to increase the number of NATO troops. Or if we left, the risk of Taliban returning. So there was a difficult dilemma. We made a difficult decision, and we have seen the consequences, but there would have also been risks and consequences if we decided to stay. Then on Libya, that's a very important question. And I think it also demonstrates that when European allies ask NATO for help, NATO is there. So if European allies need high readiness forces, we are here. 45,000, NATO response force. We will see how NATO forces in Kosovo work hand in hand with EU diplomats and helping to solve some of the crisis there. Recently with the border issues between Kosovo and Serbia. We see how NATO in Bosnia and Herzegovina support the EU efforts. So we see in many places, or in the Aegean Sea, where we deploy NATO ships to support EU implementing an agreement with Turkey. So when European allies ask NATO for help, we are there.
So is there still a need for a rapid reaction force then, an EU rapid reaction
force? We have a rapid reaction force. We have the NATO response force, 45,000. So, and that's exactly what we saw in Libya. So I was then again Prime Minister of Norway. I was in Paris when they made the decision. I supported the decision, but NATO was not at the table. NATO was not at the table when they decided the air campaign against Libya. It was a European initiative supported by, of course, France, United Kingdom, but also Norway. I take full responsibility. But it was not a NATO decision. It was without NATO. NATO was not part of the decision. Then after some days and some weeks, European allies, including Norway, realized that we didn't have the resources. We didn't have the ammunition, we didn't have the capabilities, we didn't have the air-to-air refueling. So we went to NATO, and NATO provided support. So in a way, there are Kosovo, Bosnia, Aegean Sea, Libya, very different, but all are European needs that NATO helps to fill. So NATO is there also for Europe.
Maybe one last minute on arms control, because I promised my colleagues that you will be done here by 10:35. And
yeah, that's 1 minute.
Yes.
But the problem is not the questions. The problem is the long answers. Yeah. So no, but on arms control, also we are always ready to sit down and discuss arms control. NATO has been working for arms control, including the Open Skies Treaty. But we saw some compliance issues from the Russian side. We also regret the Russian decision, but we are ready to talk. We are ready for dialogue. And for me, dialogue and arms control is not a sign of weakness. It's actually that we are confident, we are strong, we are united, so we are never afraid of talking to Russia.
Thank you very much. And that was really professional. 10:35 and we are done. We are tremendously grateful that you took the time. I think it was a very difficult spot you were in. Yeah. And now we cannot keep a very important woman waiting any longer. We are approaching the Chancellery and Chancellor Merkel, who is a bit more important than we are. So you are excused. Yeah. And thank you very much for your time and your energy and your spirit.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great honor to be here. Thank you.